Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
And welcome to episode 13. I'm Marnie Werner, Research Director at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Kathy Drager wants rural communities to see their local grocery stores as the assets they are. Kathy is the statewide director of the University of Minnesota Extension's Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, five regional organizations devoted to helping rural communities grow and thrive. But small-town grocery stores have been facing an uphill battle against increasing competition from the big national chains. In this interview, Kathy and Julie will be talking about the important roles small grocery stores play in their communities, especially in a time of COVID, and the innovations she and her team have developed to help them succeed.
Hello, and welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast. My name is Julie Tesh, and I am the president and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Today on our podcast, we have Kathy Drager, who is the statewide director of the University of Minnesota Extension Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. Welcome to the show, Kathy.
Thank you, Julie.
Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Glad to. So thank you for inviting me to your podcast today. I've been a long admirer of the work of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. So it's great to be able to have a conversation with you. I actually come to this work from kind of the agricultural science side. My background and training is in soil science, where as a graduate student, I studied and researched edible dry bean production. And I also have my doctorates in water resource sciences. And as part of my thesis research, I looked at how watershed districts, which are located throughout greater Minnesota, how watershed districts can make impacts on water quality. What is the work that they're doing, and what are the most effective ways for watershed districts to impact water quality? You can probably hear some noisy birds in the background.
Yeah.
I am lucky that I married a farmer. And we bought the family farm in Big Stone County, Minnesota, which is on the western edge of the state. So I was able to join today from the shores of Big Stone Lake. And it looks like the Blue Jays are migrating to Big Stone County right now. And I'm grateful in Big Stone County that we have a telecommunications co-op, Federated, that made an investment in fiber optic, because when we bought the farm 12 years ago, I simply would not have been able to move here and telecommute to my job on the St. Paul campus if it weren't for a rural electric co-op that laid down high-speed fiber optic cable and internet to our farm. So I am able to, for example, join this and participate fully in my work remotely. And especially during these times of COVID, it's especially fortuitous that we have good rural electric, telecommunication co-ops that made that investment.
Oh, that's fantastic. I'm looking forward to fiber one day on our farm, but I digress. Why don't you tell us about the work of, I'll say the RSDP, but the Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships.
Yes, glad to. The regional partnerships were formed by the Minnesota legislature in 1997, which I believe is the same year as the Center for Rural Policy and Development. So we're kind of sister organizations in that sense.
Correct.
And it was a group of really active, engaged citizens and some highly, value mission-driven faculty who really wanted to make sure that the University of Minnesota continued to engage closely with rural communities throughout the state to build partnerships that could advance sustainable development. And those were the values this program was founded on, and we continue to serve those values. We work with communities in any given year. We have about 120 to 135 or so projects around the state. Those projects are all the vast majority are all come to us via communities that have an innovation or they have a need and they would like to get some support from their land grant university to address that need. We do have four focus areas that we work in. Sustainable ag and food systems is an area where we do a lot of work. For example, we work with deep winter greenhouses. It's a technology that we've been able to help research and develop. The rural grocery store work kind of falls in that area. We do clean energy work, which is through our clean energy resource teams that are active throughout the state. And then we have natural resources, and then we have resilient communities and sustainable tourism.
That's fantastic. And remind me, how many regions are there?
Thank you. We have five regions around the state. So there's Northeast, Northwest, Central, Southeast, and Southwest. So we have five governing boards, and each of those boards has is composed of like two-thirds community members and one-third faculty. And each of those boards also gets some seed funding so that they can support those projects that come in from communities. Now, we can't always support every project, but we work hard to bring resources to as many of those projects as we can. You may need a graduate student. For example, we're doing some case studies on soil health throughout the state. And we have some grad students working on those to develop those case studies. And so we have some seed funding that can support, you know, the community members, it can support students working, it can support, you maybe want to do a survey, we can bring in some resources to help with things like that. Or maybe we've been doing some planning, for example, for community centers or how we could reuse historic buildings. And then we can bring in, you know, some architecture faculty or students to help a community re-envision what that empty building on Main Street could be used for. So that's kind of our form and function. And so we have our boards are really the decision-making body on what projects we work on in any given year.
That's fantastic. So if I were in a community somewhere in Minnesota, in rural Minnesota, and I have an idea for a project, how would I go about working with RSDP?
We actually kind of pride ourselves on being kind of easy entry. So a good place to start would be to click or go on your computer to rsdp.umn.edu and figure out which region you're in. It's probably pretty straightforward for most people, but you could just click on a region and you'll see which counties we cover. And then you could either reach out to the executive director. We have an executive director in each of our five regions of the state. They live and work and are embedded in the community and they are accessible. And then if you actually have an idea, let's say I'll just use that example of that historic building on Main Street that really needs to have some more community visioning and a little bit of, you know, maybe some architectural eyes put on it to see what could be done with it. Then we do every year, we do an open call for ideas. And generally that's from January 1st to February 14th. And it's a pretty simple procedure. Just give us some information, a few sentences about the idea, the innovation or the issue you have. And then one of our executive directors will get back to you. And then our boards, and we actually have work groups in each part of the state, they will review those ideas and then they call in a portion of those for more information, what we call a proposal. And then those proposals are voted on by the board and then we're rocking and rolling and you're part of our portfolio of work for the year and then we're able to help that community. So one way to access the RSDPs is via the idea form. If you want to see some of our past work or what resources we have, again, go to that website, rsdp.umn.edu. For example, you might be interested in if you could build a deep winter greenhouse on your farm or at your grocery store or at your school or at your food shelf. And we actually have the blueprints and the construction materials list. Those are all available and you could download those for free and, you know, have access to some of those resources as well. And then I would say a kind of a third and a fourth way that you could engage with RSDPs is that we invite people to serve on our boards. And then, and sometimes we have more requests for board seats than we have board seats available. But, you know, we welcome people to apply, but we also have work groups. So for example, let's say you're really passionate about clean energy. We actually have clean energy work groups around the state, and you could put in an application and serve on our work groups as well. Or same thing for sustainable ag and food systems, or if you have some natural resource issues as well. So there's a variety of ways you can access us for your ideas and your projects, for the resources that we have available and the work we've done in the past. And also, if you'd be interested in working with other people in your region on addressing sustainable development in your part of the state.
That is great. You know, there's so many aspects of the University of Minnesota that I know most people don't know about, especially, you know, the outreach work, which is so important. So, gosh, I'm glad that you're on the show today and that we're able to talk about RSDP and all that you do. You have a vast background, obviously, in the sciences and soil science, plant science. Tell me about a project that you are especially passionate about with RSDP.
Yes. So, yes, you're right. I do kind of have my roots in the sciences. But even through my work as a scientist, I was always interested in how that work fit in with the communities. You know, for example, my research on edible dry beans, it's one thing to tell you what's the best bean, but if you don't ask people what they want to eat, what good is having the best, you know, red bean when people really want pinto beans, for example? So I've always thought that our research needs to connect back to community. And so I'd love to talk to you about some of the work we're doing with rural grocery stores around the state. And because of the timing of this podcast, it's really, really good timing to talk about this because we're just releasing the results of a statewide survey we did of rural grocery stores. Having moved to Big Stone County, and I can tell you as a scientist and as a community member and, you know, someone who works with the University of Minnesota Extension, that living and experiencing life in a remote, or, you know, a remote rural county is one of the best educations that a person like me can have. You know, my husband and our three kids moved from St. Paul to outside of Clinton, Minnesota is the closest town, population 450. Love Clinton, Minnesota. And the difference between grocery shopping in St. Paul and grocery shopping in Clinton, Minnesota was really eye-opening. And I came to really appreciate what a gem and what a benefit it is to have a small town grocery store on Main Street. And from there, I got really curious about how the supply chains work. How are we keeping food on the shelves of these rural grocery stores? You know, what is the process? What does it work? How does it work for farmers to get their local foods into these grocery stores? There were just so many questions that we could ask, and really looking at these grocery stores as important community assets. And I know that the Center for Rural Policy and Development, I think it was over 10 years ago, you started some of this first research on and really brought attention to our state about the crisis and the closure of many rural grocery stores in the state. So I want to thank you. It was your data that really made us appreciate the grocery stores that we do have remaining on the landscape. And in Minnesota, we have about 250 grocery stores in communities of population 2,500 or less. And while we have seen many grocery stores close, where we need to appreciate and support the grocers that we have remaining on the landscape. Because through the years, I think your data would show as well as ours that it's much harder to open a new grocery store. Once a community loses their grocery store, it's very hard to reopen that store and reestablish all the infrastructure that you need to have a thriving business, a thriving grocery business. So through the years, we've done a lot of research on grocery stores. The survey helped us refine what needs to be done. And then from that survey, we learned about what are some of the needs for grocers. there was some issues about produce handling. Loss of produce was an issue, and these small town stores, it's not like in St. Paul where you actually have a produce manager. You know, many times it's the owner of the store who's serving many roles at their grocery store. So we were able to come up with a produce handling guide, and then we went around the state and we held kind of education sessions for grocers to learn how they can handle and best display and have the longest shelf life of the produce in their stores. We also heard that grocers were having issues with the transition of their stores from one generation to the next, or the sale of that store. So we were able to work with some colleagues in Extension as well on, you know, what might be some supportive business transition materials for these stores. So we've been able to learn about the stores and then also work with these grocery stores on things that would be of value to them. I can just give you one other example. I know a lot of people are interested in local foods, and it's, you know, we're getting into late fall in Minnesota where we've had an abundance of, you know, apples and squash and, you know, pumpkins. And we found that many of the grocers, over 40% of the grocers, were interested in having more local foods in their grocery store. And so, but they were really concerned about the regulatory issues. So over the past few months, we've helped develop a farm to rural grocery toolkit. And we are in the process of getting that out to all the grocers and any interested farmers as well on what do we need to do to have food from your farm be able to be sold in that grocery store. You know, that could be meat. Although there's, you know, we lay out all the regulatory needs for shell eggs and meat and vegetables, fruits, grains, you know, things like popcorn or edible beans or barley. So we built this farm to rural grocery toolkit, and we are deploying that across the state to help kind of support the food system.
Now, where can people find those resources?
So, thank you, Julie. If you go to rsdp.umn.edu, we actually have a section right on that front page on rural grocery stores. And if you click on that, you can just go down to resources, and it's the top one. It's the Farm to Rural Grocery Toolkit. It's an easy to read, easy to follow toolkit. And we welcome anyone who is interested in sharing that, download it, and share it as far and wide as you would like.
Great. You know, it's interesting you talked about when a grocery store leaves a community, it's difficult for them to come back in. And I know that we're talking about communities of 2,500 and or less, but I think of our county seat of Waseca. They mm-hmm. lost their grocery store, and I don't know all the reasons, but it was a Hy-Vee, and it's a town of 10,000, so it's considerably bigger. But they left, and then another grocery chain, Cashwise, came in, and they didn't even make it a year. Mm. And so it's hard to get that community spirit in there. And so a town of 10,000 of Waseca has Walmart. Yeah. That's all we have. And mm-hmm. it has everything people need, but you're missing something in the community when there's not a community-based grocery store there. So it is really difficult.
Yes. And I think that actually the data that came out of the Center for Rural Policy and Development showed that Southeast Minnesota is actually one of the regions that has lost the most grocery stores. And it's because you have so many regional centers that compete yep. with those grocery stores. Whereas in all honesty, in Western Minnesota, where, you know, there's, you know, for the people who live in Clinton, it's a long ways to a regional center. And so that actually, surprisingly, being remote is more protective of keeping those small town grocery stores in business than being someplace as well populated as Southeastern Minnesota is, for example.
Yeah, that's just, it is crazy because I know my staff and I, we've been discussing shopping patterns and how they've changed over the years. What, you know, anywhere on Main Street, the hardware store, clothing stores, you know, we're getting more things online, but, you know, in remote rural areas or even in a rural area like mine, I'm not necessarily very remote, but, you know, you still need to get your fresh produce and eggs and milk and whatnot. And so it's interesting just watching the shopping patterns of rural Minnesota change and ebb and maybe not even change in some of the remote areas.
Yeah. And the competition is changing. Our rural grocery survey shows a huge amount of increase in remote and rural areas from, for example, dollar stores. And that is a phenomenon that's been sweeping our state really the last 5 years, that we've just seen a real proliferation of dollar stores. But, and I'm guessing that many of your listeners hold these same values, but I encourage, whenever I'm asked to talk about rural grocery stores, I encourage the audience to really think about voting with your food dollars and voting for these Main Street businesses like your local grocery store, because they are important assets for a community. Yes, it's very important for food access, but it's also, you know, it also brings people to town for, you know, people might use the restaurant or fill up with gas or do some other business in their community. But when that grocery store is gone, there's a lot fewer reasons for people to venture into these towns. So make sure, you know, you use your local grocery stores. And I will also say that, and this doesn't show in our data because this just happened as a result of COVID-19, but when COVID-19 hit, the business at rural grocery stores skyrocketed. And we need to keep these diverse supply chains going, because where other communities were running out of beef and toilet paper and some of those items, we found that the supply chains were sufficiently different for these small town independent grocers that they still had some of those items on their shelves. And in fact, I can give you an example. There's a national shortage of canning lids right now, because it's canning season.
Yes, there is.
And yet Main Street, and I'll say this now, I better make sure I'm stocked up, but Main Street Clinton, the grocery store in Clinton, Minnesota, actually had, at least a few days ago, still had canning lids available in that community. So what we're finding is that a resilient food system, it's important, and they need to... We need to invest with, as individuals, as families, as community members, make sure that your grocery dollars are staying in that community and not just stopping in for, you know, toilet paper, bananas, and a gallon of milk if you ran out of those in between your Walmart run that you maybe do every other week. Really look at how you can work with your local grocer. And this is just another aside, but my experience and what we've heard from grocers that, you know, my family, for what we always drink organic milk. We've always drunk Organic Valley milk. Even though I have three children, we continue to buy Organic Valley milk. And when I moved to Clinton, Minnesota, the farm outside of Clinton, we couldn't access that unless I brought it back in a cooler from the cities. And we just went and talked to the grocer, and the grocer carries organic milk for us, both whole milk and 1%, because our family's kind of half and half. And in fact, that milk costs less in Clinton than it does in Fargo. But the deal is, when we go on vacation, because I have two 16-year-old boys who can drink a half gallon a day, so when we go on vacation, the grocer needs to know so that she can order a little bit less milk that week, because Jorgensen boys aren't going to be drinking it. But grocers are more than willing to do that type of work with their customers. So, you know, you can get anything you want with your local grocer. You just need to talk to them.
That's where that community really comes in. And so, talking about the research that's coming out, where, you know, Thanksgiving is coming up, mm-hmm. You know, and thinking about rural grocery stores and where should I shop, and just thinking about the future of rural, we're just getting done with a contentious election. Mm-hmm. And just, again, looking at business models, are rural grocery stores still a viable business model?
Yes. I would say our survey findings showed that more than half, about 62% of our survey respondents, felt that their business is thriving as a business. But I will also say that an overwhelming majority, now granted this was pre-COVID, but still an overwhelming majority of the grocers, 88%, did have concerns about their store's economic sustainability. Many of the stores, the majority of stores report that year over year, their revenue, annual revenue was about the same. But that about 38% of those grocers said that their revenue was lower than previous years. And I think, Julie, it gets back to what you were saying about the competition and the change of consumer grocery shopping. Like, if you know you can drive to Aldi's or Walmart, or, you know, your spouse works in a urban or a regional center, and they can just pick up, you know, those 30 items you need after they're done with work. I think that those change in shopping patterns are reflected in what these grocers are saying, where about 38% of them are seeing lower revenue. Now, COVID, I think, has been a good shock to the system and made people aware that they were kind of grateful that they had a smaller Main Street business that provides the full shopping cart. You know, you can get fresh fruits and vegetables and meat and dairy and, you know, boxed and canned and frozen foods as well. Like, knowing that that is there in your community, I think a lot of people have recognized that this is an important part of making sure that you've got a resilient food system in case anything else should happen. You know, I mean, there could always be different shocks to the supply chain system in any given time. And so I think people are really recognizing that these stores are assets. And again, so hopefully we will be able to, you know, see more people, you know, using that grocery store as the primary place to get food.
Yeah, it's trying to find those silver linings from COVID. You know, it's such an awful situation, but there are those silver linings. And like you said, having those local small town grocery stores available, I know people that they don't feel comfortable going into a larger grocery store, you know, uh-huh. for health reasons and whatnot. And those grocery stores are, you know, it's their saving grace. It's the yep. only place that they'll go. And so it's really been interesting watching that trend. And I'll be curious, you know, some research maybe we can partner on in the future on how, you know, maybe a year from now, how grocery stores are doing. But I want to touch on more of the COVID, and, you know, it's obviously negatively affected everyone across the country. But RSDP, you guys came up with some really cool, innovative ways to help people who are experiencing food insecurity, because that could be a whole nother topic, food insecurity uh-huh. in rural Minnesota.
Yep.
But people who need to self-isolate during COVID, tell me about the 14-day meal kit that your team developed.
Yes. So this actually we did in partnership with rural grocery stores, which reviewed this and helped us test it really quickly, like immediately upon end of the first week of March, we had brought this together. We thought that there would be a need if people were not in the habit of keeping enough food on hand to isolate for 14 days, which many families don't anymore. You can buy meals to go or just pick up a few items at a time, a meal at a time, a couple days at a time. And if we thought that there was a family that was going to need to isolate themselves for 14 days, that this might be a hardship. Plus, I thought it might just be good to think about our community food supply in terms of just building up a little reserve, not necessarily hoarding, but a 14-day meal kit where if you needed to, or you knew someone, a neighbor or elderly person who needed to isolate, that this would be a ready-to-go as nutritionally balanced meal as possible. So we built a couple of these and tested them and came up with basically a menu, and that is also available at rsdp.uofm.edu. It is instructions and a shopping list and a meal plan for a 14-day meal kit. It's basically two hot meals, kind of a breakfast and a dinner, and then some kind of, you know, like snack type foods for in between. And we wanted to find something that was available in these rural grocery stores. So there's, you know, it's a pretty standard American diet. And it would also be something that if you were not feeling well, because we weren't sure when this pandemic started, you know, if someone had to isolate, but they in fact had COVID, they may not feel well enough to like start from scratch with, you know, a lot of raw ingredients. So there's a lot of ready to make meals in there. And so it needed to be accessible. It needed to be affordable. And, you know, it needed to be more or less nutritionally balanced. You know, there's a lot of canned food in it, which, you know, many people nowadays are used to having more, you know, kind of a fresh food. But we were thinking this is just 14 days and you're in isolation. So I won't make any excuses, but, you know, I think it actually says spam on the list. So, but we were really happy at the reception this has received. It's been downloaded over 7,000 times all around the United States. I had a group that translated that 14-day meal kit into a vegan list. So they basically swapped out some of the things that we had on and turned it into a 14-day vegan meal kit. We also were contacted for some people were sheltering in hotels. And what would this meal kit look like if you only had access to hot water and a microwave? How could you do this? So people did a lot of riffing, you know, on, okay, here's a core idea. And I've still received to this time, thank you notes from communities that are deploying this around the state throughout greater Minnesota. And that they created these meal kits and were able to have them on reserve. If they knew that a family was, you know, in quarantine, they had them, they could deploy these meal kits quickly. I know of some churches that built some and had them on hand in case some of their elderly members needed to isolate, or they had members that were in this situation, or even community members. Community groups have been, you know, I think there was a group of retired volunteers in Northwest Minnesota that built a number of these kits so that they could be deployed if a wave of COVID hit in that part of the state. So that was one of our first strategies when COVID hit, just to say, okay, let's try to build in a little bit of reserve so that if there's a, you know, family in need, those could be deployed really quickly. So that, you know, if an elderly person didn't want to go to the grocery store, that would be one way to bring in 14 days of meals for that particular family. And then I'd call it phase two, when we started seeing that there was growing concern about the infection rate among grocery workers. I think we heard, you know, earlier in the pandemic that, you know, grocery stores were one of the few places still open, and some of those grocery store workers were starting to get ill with COVID. So then we worked with grocers and developed a system for how they could have curbside and delivery service. And we just put forward a really simple method, basically a call-in, get your name on a list, and then you kind of have a personal shopper in the store who can fill up your shopping cart, and then you could either pick that up or have it delivered. And people were volunteering to deliver groceries, and the curbside pickup really got to be more and more popular. But we actually published a fact sheet on how a small town grocery store that doesn't have an online platform, but still is important to that community, how they could do a curbside pickup and delivery program. And they could basically close their grocery store doors and keep their business going with that model. And then our phase three of our COVID was really partly this farm to rural grocery, so that we knew that we would have those direct supply chains. So, you know, in Big Stone County, we actually have a couple wonderful apple orchards. And yet you could go to Clinton and buy apples from New Zealand. So what do we really need to do to make sure that local foods are getting into local grocery stores? And that really is a part of food resilience as well. And then another part of this work I'm super excited about is, and this is really phase four, which we're just embarking on right now, is how we can use these rural grocery stores then to backhaul local foods into the supply chain. And I'll just, if I could quickly explain this, about twice the wholesale truck in, I'll give Clinton, Minnesota as an example. The wholesale truck comes from Wadena, Minnesota to Clinton, and it backs up to the dock, which is basically a door, and it unloads milk and, you know, cereal and fruits, vegetables, you know, coffee, pepper, spices, you know, diapers, toilet paper, you name it. Those all come off the wholesale truck. And this wholesale truck is it's a semi truck with three compartments. Has a compartment for your dry goods, has a compartment for your refrigerated goods, and it has a compartment for freezers, for frozen food. And then that truck will turn around after visiting a few stores and taking the food off, and it goes back empty to the wholesaler. So what if we were in need of a regional food system that needed to be put into place? What if when that truck backed up into Clinton and unloaded those pallets of food, that it could maybe load up excess pallets of apples that were above and beyond what that grocery store could sell, and loaded up that pallet of apples, and then it was backhauled into the wholesale warehouse where the truck is going anyway, and then it could be redistributed throughout the region. And we actually were able to test that, and we got regulatory approval for this process. It was approved by both the Department of Agriculture, and we were able to test it. And in fact, we were able to backhaul a crop. In this case, it was garlic, and that crop ended up in St. Paul. It from a remote rural place in Minnesota ended up in St. Paul and Fargo, you know, and in small town grocers around the region. So we're looking at that as kind of a phase four. Like if we needed to have a low miles, existing infrastructure, existing truck routes, existing loading docks, existing people who are working every day in the food supply, we could actually use these grocery stores as 250, I'll call them points of light, but they're really assets that they don't just have to be the back end of a food supply chain, like the place where the last stop where before consumers buy, but it could be the first stop on a really robust regional food system as well, where we're actually using it not just to bring in food, but it could be the point where farms can access the market and get their foods into the wholesale market. So we're really excited about, you know, really figuring out what we need to do to make a system like that work smoothly. And I think COVID is just the perfect reason why we should be looking at what makes a resilient regional food system and how grocery stores can be a front door for farmers and ultimately for consumers to have access to local foods.
Absolutely. Gosh, you know, just thinking about, I remember hearing about, you know, the 14-day kit and the other work, but how far it's come in such a short amount of time. Yeah. Is really remarkable. And I know a lot of people across the state, urban or rural, do wonder about food security and, you know, supply and demand. And yeah, I'd rather buy apples from a local grower than from New Zealand. So I'm really excited to see how this advances past COVID. And gosh, that is just really neat. I need to ask you, I know you have a task force that works with rural grocery stores and they're maybe struggling. Can you tell me a good success story of a rural grocery store that maybe was in some trouble and now they're doing much better or doing well?
That is a really, really good question. I do see a number of stores that we stop in and we have seen some success stories where some stores have closed and now there are people interested in opening those stores up. So I can think of, you know, there's three towns, you know, Winthrop, Minnesota, they have a new young owner of their grocery store in that town. And I'd encourage people driving through, feel free to stop and, you know, give them some of your business. I'm seeing a lot of small town stores that do seem to be doing very well. You know, Milan, Minnesota, for example, they're a cute little store that serves both kind of the old timer Scandinavian community and their you know, the newer immigrants who are the Micronesians. So you can buy both lingonberries and Norwegian fish balls, and you can buy octopus and, you know, hot sauce as well. So I think there are some examples of how communities change and the grocers change with the communities and can be that important, you know, kind of third place, that community gathering spot where people come around, come together around food, even if those foods are, even if those foods are different than what we are traditionally used to seeing. So I think we are seeing a growing appreciation of these rural grocers and their role. And I am hopeful that in light of COVID, that some of these grocers have had, you know, their community appreciation has increased as well.
That's fantastic. I want to stop at that grocery store. Gosh, if they have lingonberries and octopus, wow. That sounds like something you'd get at like Lund's or Byerly's or something in the cities. That sounds pretty cool. Sounds pretty cool. What is your vision for the future of rural grocery stores? I know COVID has definitely made people appreciate rural grocery stores more, but with that report coming out and with that point in time pre-COVID, you know, let's look 5 years down the road. What's your vision for the future of rural grocery stores in Minnesota?
Well, my hope for rural grocery stores is that that they see a reversal in those trends for their revenue. My hope would be that in 5 years that we are seeing these rural grocery stores increase their revenues year on year, and that they are viewed as community assets and even as assets in the food supply chain. My hope would be that not only can they be part of the global food supply chain with all those other items I mentioned earlier, bananas, coffee, pepper, all those things we love that come from around the world, but they can also be the front door for a lot of interesting and delicious local foods as well. So that they are both part of the, you know, the food coming in as well as the food going out to consumers. And I'm grateful, you know, a couple of years ago, the legislature passed the Good Food Access Fund program so that some of these stores that maybe are struggling with infrastructure, investment in produce coolers, those types of things, I hope we can see the public good. We know that many of these are private businesses. Some of them are co-ops, some of them are community owned, but that we have a greater appreciation of the public good that these rural grocery stores have, and that we're able to continue to support programs like the Good Food Access Fund so that, you know, grocers can get a little assistance when they need to improve things like produce coolers. Produce coolers is a huge gap at a lot of these stores around the state. So my hope, I would say that pretty much sums up my hope, that the business model continues to thrive and expand, that there's a greater appreciation and the role of these stores in communities, and that we can acknowledge the tremendous amount of public good that comes from these set of stores around the state.
That would be so wonderful. I look forward to 2025. That seems like something crazy to say, but you know, hopefully people will still be utilizing their rural grocery stores even more and finding, you know, more access, more availability. And like you said before, talk to your local grocer, ask them if they can get in certain products that you would like and that you know that you would buy consistently. You know, your milk example was just a great idea, you know. So, and remind our listeners again where they can find all of this wonderful information about rural grocery stores and rural food.
Yes. So please go to rsdp.umn.edu. And while you're there, if you have a community idea, we welcome you to submit an idea to the RSDPs. We can work with you on whatever your innovation or need or issue is. You know, feel free to apply to serve on one of our boards. We always welcome people on our boards and our work groups. And our rural grocery and many of our other resources are right on that same front page at rsdp.uofm.edu. We've got a whole section there on rural grocery stores, as well as our clean energy work, our work with deep winter greenhouses. And we have a story map that you could just click and look at the 135 projects we had this fiscal year, for example, because we've got a lot of interesting things going around the state, you know, historic buildings and food systems and clean energy and natural resources. And we just welcome people to connect with us in any way that would serve your needs.
Wonderful. Kathy Drager, Statewide Director of the University of Minnesota Extension Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships. Thank you very much. And thank you for your passion for rural Minnesota. And I would love to talk to you someday about living in St. Paul and moving out to a rural area, because I did a similar thing. So that'll be another episode. So thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, Julie.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.